Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money. This is Larry Warren along with Doug Wells, and we're going to have Doug, a wide variety of topics today.
A little wider than normal.
We're going to delve into Hidden Tuscany with an old friend of mine who's a prolific author on all things related to Italy, John Cahey, Salt Lake Trib reporter from days back, who discovered Italy some time ago. And we're going to talk about the business of publishing, but also we're going to stray from hardcore business topics and just have a little fun. That's in the second half of the show.
Talk about travel.
And indeed.
Our first guest is going to be Meredith Ferguson. She's an assistant professor of management at Utah State University. And she's going to talk to us about toxic workplace environments and the impact on people's health and just their general well-being, as well as other topics related to that.
And who hasn't worked in a place where either the boss is abusive or fellow workers or someone in the workplace?
Yeah, unfortunately, we all have a more experience with that than we'd like to.
We all have our horror stories.
And we're going to talk to Professor Ferguson about that. More on Mountain Money coming up. You're listening to KPCW. Please stay tuned.
Hi, this is Kevin Stocking, president of Heber Valley Bank. We offer a full spectrum of loans for lots, construction, HELOCs, commercial, and personal needs. Our loan decisions are made locally. Heber Valley Bank is a proud supporter of KPCW. We are located in Heber City and Midway and at Grand Valley Bank in Park City. HeberValleyBank.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Juniper Landing is proud to support our local radio station, KPCW. Juniper Landing is a new, whole ownership townhome community located at the base of Canyons Resort, adjacent to the Waldorf Astoria Park City, with a model open daily. Our website is JuniperLandingParkCity.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Our first guest this morning is Professor Meredith Ferguson. She is an assistant professor of management at Utah State University. Good morning, Meredith.
Good morning.
Well, thanks for first off, thanks for being on the show with us today.
It's my pleasure.
So let's start. So you have some expertise in toxic workplace environments. Let's start with, what was it about that topic that was of interest to you?
That's a great question. I had a number of friends, family members who, the ones that stand out to me are the ones that had what we would call an abusive supervisor, and that tends to create an environment of toxicity, kind of along with incivility, which is a little less egregious, or I would say substantially probably less egregious. And when I would talk to those people, they would talk about the stress and how it impacted their life at work and their health and impacted their family. And so that's really how I got interested in it. It's just kind of anecdotal evidence from people that I knew who'd been in those situations.
Okay, so it was something close to home. Now, I'm curious, is part of your expertise also in it once the toxic workplace has been identified and maybe there's one or two people that are really driving the majority of that? Do you do some coaching? Do you do some helping of the executives as to how to maybe change their style?
I have not ventured into kind of the consulting part of it. More of my efforts are focused on how do we prevent it in the first place, and a lot of that comes down to how we hire, who we hire, and the kind of overall culture that we create.
Well, Meredith, are you talking mostly about the bosses? Is it mostly the bosses who create a toxic environment, or can it just be the way employees treat each other? I mean, what's the more serious or more common problem?
I would say the more serious problem is the abuse of supervisors, but the more common problem is incivility. About 14% of Americans have said they have experienced or been the target of an abusive supervisor. And when we talk about abusive supervisors, we're talking about supervisors who come out as outwardly hostile, and you know, they scream and yell at a subordinate in front of other people, and they slam doors, and they belittle people, or maybe they take advantage of a situation and say, take credit for a subordinate's work, things like that, things that are openly hostile. Incivility is different because it's basically just kind of low-level, rude behaviors, but it has, which most people would look at and go, you know, that's not that big of a deal. But what we find is that it has some of the same effects that trickle outside of the workplace, that impact the family, that the more egregious being the target of abusive supervisor might have.
So incivility is the main culprit. So how does that manifest itself between a boss and an employee?
Well, with incivility, civility, it's much more about, yeah, it's just basic rudeness. So talking down to others, maybe talking in a condescending way, not listening to what people say, talking over them, withholding information maybe from somebody who needs that information to perform their job, kind of just making demeaning or derogatory remarks. So some people may not even mean to be rude or uncivil. It's just, it's become maybe part of the culture. It's maybe part of their personality. And so a lot of people would look at that and say, oh, that's not that big of a deal. But what we find is that it is.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. As Larry and I kind of jokingly mentioned at the open, unfortunately, most of us have had that experience, and it's awful.
Right? Absolutely.
Usually what folks do in that situation is they start looking for another job because it's just too hard to change the status quo.
Absolutely.
So let's talk to us about what companies can do to prevent this type of culture from starting in the first place.
That's a great question. There are a number of things that organizations can do. One that I mentioned earlier is trying to hire and attract and recruit and select people that are maybe already pre-wired to be more civil and to be more respectful of other people. There's selection that you can make based on personality, some integrity tests that a number of organizations use to try and select in people that are going to behave with integrity, to treat others with integrity and respect, and to weed out those that are less likely to behave that way, especially people that are, we tend to find people that are much more egotistical, think a whole lot of themselves, are often more inclined to treat people disrespectfully. Once you get people in your organization, there's also a number of things that you can do to create a better environment. One is through building basically civility competencies, whether that's teaching people how to be better listeners. I teach the negotiation conflict resolution class here at Utah State. Honestly, it's a class I think every undergraduate should have, whether you're a business student or not, because it helps people learn how to solve conflict in a way that benefits the relationship instead of damaging the relationship and people around them. So there's some of those competencies that organizations can help their employees build.
Now, of course, the best way to avoid having a bully in the workplace is to not hire that person in the first place, and there are some testing things, I suppose, but everybody calls references, and I would think in the litigious society we have, when you call for a reference, you're not going to necessarily get the fact that, oh, we're glad that guy left because he was a bully.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So how do you vet someone aside from running them through personality tests?
I think a lot of times you can pay attention, you know, one, to what references that you call say, but also what they don't say, because a lot of them are going to be unwilling to share any information that might be perceived as negative because they are concerned about getting sued, and that's why a lot of organizations will, you know, share their hire date, their termination date, and maybe their title, and not much else. I think that's what makes it so important to kind of work that informal network. A lot of organizations want to hire using, like, employee referrals because that person hopefully has already been somewhat informally vetted. And then, you know, sometimes it can be very difficult to avoid hiring someone who's going to behave badly. So if they do get in your organization, it's really important to take those, any complaints that you get, especially from subordinates, but also from vendors, from coworkers, because a lot of times if you've got a bully, they're not just being a bully to their subordinate, they're being a bully to everyone around them, unless it's someone who can do something for them, so maybe their boss. But take those complaints seriously, gather the data, get the information, do the interviews with people, and then you have to act quickly because the longer it takes management or human resources to act, that tends to further victimize the subordinates or the victims, and it tends to embolden the bully.
Yeah, and let's go back to references as well, because I've got a suggestion and wanted your thoughts on it, and then a follow-up on a previous comment from yours, and that is, when you're talking to references, you want to get a feel for who else that person has a relationship with that may not be on their reference list. I like to get off the reference list as quickly as possible. And in a world of Facebook and in a world of LinkedIn, it's easier than ever to do that. So I'm curious on your thoughts on that, and then I was wondering if you have any resources for relatively inexpensive testing tools that a small business or a medium-sized business could use to kind of test folks on the front end.
Sure. I think, you know, employment law, and I am not an attorney, and so that's not my area of expertise, but I know from people that I've talked with on the subject, employment law on doing searches on, you know, especially something like Facebook and even somewhat LinkedIn can be somewhat of a gray area. So I think if you don't hire someone based on what you find on Facebook or LinkedIn, you may open yourself up to liability there, and you know, that also depends on the state and the situation that you're in. So I know some people who use it, but I also know a lot of organizations who prohibit the use. But I think you can find some information. That's one thing I advise all of my students once they're on the job market to, you know, really look over their Facebook page, because some organizations will look, and I say, you know, you probably don't want to have that Facebook picture with you with the adult beverage in your hand and looking like you're partying too much. You want the appropriate face to the public in case people are looking. One of the things I would suggest for especially like small businesses who are looking to use some sort of personality testing or other tools to try and weed out people before they get in their organization is to go to the Society for Human Resource Management website. It's shrm.org, and there are tons of resources there to help people, especially small businesses and large businesses as well, look for the tools that's right for them, for the type of job that they are trying to hire for, because some of it will depend on, you know, what kind of position and function that person is serving in, and that might drive some of the tools that they want to use, and how much time and money they also want to invest in.
Yeah, I can think of two movies, two pop culture references to toxic workplaces. One was 9 to 5. They both became funny movies, and the other was The Devil Wears Prada. One with a male villain and one with a female villain. Is there any data that suggests men are more abusive, more toxic than women, or vice versa?
Well, I think it depends on the type of behavior we're talking about, and there's some research on this, and I would say we need to do a lot more. There's a slight trend for more men to engage in the outright bullying, the hostility, what people say is abuse of supervision. Keeping in mind, though, that the way we study abuse of supervision is from the victim or the subordinate's point of view. And so what a subordinate may consider abusive, I've anecdotally know of a number of supervisors who say, oh, well, yeah, I do that, but that's not abusive. I'm trying to motivate my employees. But unfortunately, what they don't realize is they're actually undermining their subordinates' performance. And we see a bent towards incivility a little more from women. But again, both these things are really kind of in their infancy of being studied.
You know, I tell young people, first off, management is a learned skill, and even more important, leadership. And there's a big difference between leadership and management. Mm-hmm. But when you have to give somebody feedback on their job, which most of us do have to do, when you have to give feedback to somebody on the job, the goal is for them to want to work for you more and to be motivated. If they leave that meeting and they want to work for you less, or they're less motivated, you as a leader need to take that as feedback and say, I'm doing something wrong. And that's fine. Being cognizant of that is important. And then practice and talk to other people about different styles, because it's so important. And it's not natural. It's a very difficult thing to do, to give somebody feedback in a way that is motivating and positive.
Absolutely. Yeah, I tell my students, many of them want to go on to be either entrepreneurs and organizational leaders or something along those lines, they're going to be supervising other people. And I tell them, you know, pay attention to the leaders, the managers that you have, that you think are really motivating. And I tell them, when I worked for Deloitte, my first supervisor, Jeff, was fantastic. I learned a lot from him. I still feel like I use some of the behaviors and the tactics and strategies that he used to make the organization better, to make his employees better. And I tell them, I ask myself, what would Jeff Shearer do? and to look for those role models, because it is. It's a very soft skill. It takes a lot of practice. Some people get better at it very quickly, and others really, really struggle.
Has this gotten worse? Has workplace toxicity gotten worse? I'm thinking after the financial crisis, there's a lot of pressure on companies now. I would argue probably more pressure today than there was 7 years ago.
Absolutely, yes. That's exactly the trend that we are seeing. So much more stress. Organizations have downsized, and so employees are taking on much more responsibility, many more long hours. They're a lot more stressed. And a lot of times, especially with incivility, it creates stress, but it's also a stress response. They don't have the mental, the physical, the emotional, the spiritual resources to behave appropriately, and so they, you know, get snippy with someone or are so stressed out at what they're doing, they don't notice when somebody walks in and says good morning to them. They ignore them, and, you know, then the person who says good morning thinks, wow, so-and-so's such a jerk. What's their problem? And they had no idea.
Yeah, I used to, Larry and I were talking about having worked in toxic workplace environments, and it wasn't toxic, but I did have a boss that said, look, you and I are on good terms unless I tell you otherwise. And so if I said good morning and he didn't say good morning, you know, his excuse was, well, I told you, you and I are on good terms unless I tell you otherwise, and I haven't told you otherwise. And it's like, you know, I spend a lot of hours here at work. I want to feel a connection to the team that I'm working with.
Exactly, yeah. Well, and that's one, you know, there are some people, I've worked with people in the past who didn't want, it was very open, you know, more of a cubicle type of a situation where people didn't have offices, and so interruptions were problematic for them. And I learned the people who wanted you to come and stop by in the morning and say hi, and I learned the people who were like, if everybody walks in the door and comes to say hi to me, I'm never going to get anything done. So you also have to pay attention to each coworker's individual needs and kind of practice some self-awareness there.
Okay, I'll tell you one story since Doug has about my toxic boss. And he was working in a big noisy newsroom to get attention. It's hard to get everybody's attention because they're so involved with what they're doing. But he had those little baseball bats you buy for your kids at the ball games. I think when his kids grew, he brought them all to the office. And when he wanted someone's attention, he whacked a bat on the edge of their desk.
That's pretty bad.
And he broke a lot of bats and a lot of furniture and did not endear himself to anyone. No one could wait for that guy to leave. But talk also about, you have a sunrise session coming up. Utah State University runs these in Salt Lake every so often, bringing USU research down to the practical level where normal folks can hear what's going on with faculty members at USU. And the title of yours on August 1st is You Can't Leave It at the Office, Fallout from Toxic Workplace Environments. So talk a little bit about that, about the trouble when employees bring that stress from the workplace home.
Sure. Well, I will say that having an abusive supervisor and having just simply rude or uncivil coworkers have some similar effects on that employee's family life. So specifically, like with abusive supervision, that is extremely stressful. Employees often feel targeted. They perceive it as being hostile. So what we find is that they take that stress home where it creates tension in the marital relationship, and some subordinates, you know, they may not feel like they can lash back out or seek revenge on the supervisor because the ramifications there may be particularly problematic. And so whether with intent or not, they go home and take it out on their family, whether that's a spouse or kids or, you know, it's kind of that kick the dog mentality of I've had a really bad day at work and people have treated me really badly. I need a way to release the stress and the tension from that. And so they go home and are not very pleasant to live with their families. And that then impacts the functioning of the family. It impacts family satisfaction, both for the subordinate and for their spouse. And we see that it has a similar impact on marital satisfaction for both people, even when it stems from something as mild, quote, as coworker incivility. Another interesting thing about incivility is the employee's spouse will say, yes, this person comes from really stressed. That incivility then, as we say, crosses over to the spouse's workplace in the form of what we call family-to-work conflict, where the spouse's family, stress from that, time issues with that impact their workplace. So you've got incivility going on in one organization. Its effects affect the family, and then it crosses over to a whole new organization to have implications there. So it can have really broad societal implications, even something that people might consider mild, such as rudeness.
So, Meredith, we've got a couple minutes left, and I want to ask you a question that might seem a little off topic, but okay. You know, we've got a lot of high school kids that are off for the summer, some of which might be listening today. And I like to ask people how they made the decision to get into their career. And I wanted to ask you, you worked in the private sector for 5 or 7 years before you decided to go back and get your PhD. You didn't just go all the way through undergrad to your PhD. You worked, as you mentioned earlier, Deloitte and Touche for 5 or 6 years. What was it about getting your PhD and thinking about teaching in academia that was attractive to you? And what does that life look like today? I know academia, is like many places, is facing budget cuts as well. What does that career look like today?
Okay, those are great questions. I took kind of a windy route to get where I am. I had worked in banking, and then I had worked actually for a little bit in mental health. I was a psych major as an undergrad, loved my social psych class. Left banking and to do IT and some training for Deloitte, excuse me, and their culture there was one of continuous learning, and so I took a leave of absence from the firm for a little while to get my MBA, and when I went back, I loved the environment that academia offers, that always learning, always doing new things, and I think I'd always had, I have teachers all throughout my family, and so I think the teaching aspect of it kind of, I don't know if that came naturally for me, but it was something I think I was naturally interested in, and I've had professors who had an impact on me. I'm really thankful for the work experience I did have. I know a lot of people do go straight through, and I think especially in a business school, we're teaching things that are going to be applied in organizations. I'm thankful for the time that I had in the private sector, and because it gives me examples to draw on in the classroom and gives more legitimacy. I think the thing that's changing higher ed is a lot of the online and not being live in the classroom type of situations, and that works for, it's helpful to some people and for others not so much. The budget is an issue. We'll start my third year at Utah State. Before that, I've been at private institutions. But even private institutions are struggling. So I think the next 10 years will be very telling.
It will be. And I think students might be surprised. And correct me if I'm wrong on this. And in your CV, you list your classroom ratings. You do very well. Your students rate you very highly. But I would guess most of your career progression is based more on your publishing than on your teaching. And kids might be surprised to hear that. Is that accurate, or is that no longer the case?
That's accurate, and I would say it's more accurate depending on the school you're at. There are a number of universities, I would say, that a lot of people would agree it matters much more what you publish and where you publish, and your teaching doesn't really matter that much. Utah State and before Utah State, I was at Baylor University, both care about teaching, and that's one of the things that drew me to those places. I've gone to universities where research was all that mattered, and the teaching and what I got wasn't probably as fabulous, but I've also been in situations where I've had professors who weren't researching, and they were literally teaching me from notes that they wrote 20 years ago without being updated. And so, personally, I think it's important to have some mix of both, something that keeps you current and up to date, whether that's through research or doing consulting for organizations. I think there's a lot of ways to get that and stay up to date in a way that benefits your students.
Well, thanks for sharing that, Meredith. Some of us are fortunate enough to have a family circle where we can ask interesting people how they decide to get into their careers. Others of us don't have as much access, and that's the reason I ask. A radio show is a great place to share that kind of information. Our guest this morning has been Meredith Ferguson. She's an assistant professor of management and specializes on toxic workplace studies. Meredith, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Dr. Ferguson. And looking ahead to the weather for today, we're heading for a high of 82 under sunny skies. Those scattered thunderstorms that kicked off a few fires yesterday are out of the picture, not returning until maybe a slight chance on Wednesday. Going to get hot this week, up to a high of 87, and you heard the weather forecast this morning, perhaps 90-ish later in the week. So up for a hot week. And next we're going to talk about Hidden Tuscany and the business of publishing books in these days of all things digital. We'll be speaking with John Cahey, old veteran Salt Lake Trib reporter who's made it his business, his avocation to see the hidden parts of Italy. And this is a great book, and we're going to talk to John about it when we come back.
Hi, this is Greg Cropper of Jones Waldo Park City, a Park City law office. I've been a big fan of KPCW since its first broadcast back in 1980. Jones Waldo's been representing clients from Summit and Wasatch counties since 1875. You can find us at joneswaldo.com.
Hello, this is Kristen Egan of Park City Realty Group, and I support KPCW. Every day, I listen to and especially appreciate local news and weather. This has helped me live, play, and sell real estate in the Park City area for the past 14 years. I can be reached at 435-714-1067.
This is Ryan Hoffman, branch manager at Mountain West Bank.
And Brooks Harbertson, commercial lender, sponsor of Mountain Money on KPCW.
We offer several products and services for individuals and businesses, including deposit and loan solutions.
Mountain West Bank, Kearns Boulevard, next to the theater, 649-3369.
Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We have with us in the studio now John Cahey. And John, I've known for decades as a great reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune, retired a few years ago. But even as he was working as a Trib reporter, he was spending his vacations in Italy and now has written his fourth book on Italy. They're not travel guides per se. They're more, what would you describe them as, John? They're wanderings through parts of Italy not seen by all the tourists.
I think that's an apt description. I tend to refer to them as travel narratives that sort of capture a sense of people, places, culture, art, music, on occasion, and that type of thing. And was particularly strong in the last two books, a book I did on Sicily a couple of years ago and this book on Tuscany.
This book was just published last week. It's called Hidden Tuscany, Discovering Art, Culture, and Memories in a Well-Known Region's Unknown Places. Why Italy? Why aren't you intrigued with, Morocco or Africa?
I would love to be in those places, and I've traveled fairly extensively throughout Europe. The farthest east I've gotten is Turkey. My publisher, Tom Dunn, he has an imprint at St. Martin's Press, which is part of Macmillan. Tom is an Italophile, and that's how I got my first book done, was somebody pitched that idea to him, and he said, let's go for it, and then it's just been a series after that. He's been a great champion.
So run down your titles to date.
The first title came out in 2000, was Sweet and Glorious Land, Revisiting the Ionian Sea. And that was about southern Italy, the three regions of southern Italy, Calabria, Basilicata, and Puglia. Starts out in Naples and then ends up in those places, following in the footsteps of a British Victorian writer from the late 1800s who traversed that land, and I wanted to go back 100 years later and see how it had changed. The second book was about Venice Against the Sea, it was more journalism than travel narrative. It was a lot of reporting about the struggle Venice is having with high water, Acqua Alta, and that came out in 2002. The third book, about 5 years later, was Seeking Sicily. And it's a journey through myth and reality in the heart of the Mediterranean. And it is about the island of Sicily, which is still a mystery to a lot of people, and a glorious place with a rich, vibrant history of a whole series of cultures, starting with indigenous peoples, of course, and then the Greeks and the Byzantines and the Carthaginians, on up to the latest invader was in 1860, Northern Italians, when it became unified. And it tells the story of that whole aspect, and it looks at it through eyes of Sicilian writers and so forth. And I think the important thing to remember about Sicily is that they don't consider themselves part of Italy unless the national soccer team happens to be playing in the World Cup, and then they become Italians. They consider themselves north of Africa, not south of Italy. Then this book that we're talking about today is about Western Tuscany, a place that a lot of Americans don't get to. Everybody goes to Florence. After Rome, they go to Florence, they go to Siena, San Gimignano. They go to these places on the east slope of the Apennines Mountains, which is the spine of Italy. It runs the full length of the peninsula. And and they very seldom get into the very remote areas and the wonderful villages on the western slope, as well as the coastal areas, which have magnificent beaches, as well as the islands of the Tuscan archipelago.
Well, let's entice the listeners to think about going to some of these less traveled places. Mm-hmm. One of the fascinating stories in your book that I really enjoyed is a story about Michelangelo in the area where marble comes from, in Italy, Carrara, mm-hmm. I believe is the pronunciation of the town there. I really like the way you wrote, your style of writing in this book. It's very readable, and I felt in some ways I was there along with you in the trip. But tell us some of the interesting things. What makes Carrara an interesting place to visit?
Well, that's where everybody who knows anything at all about Michelangelo, you know, his David was carved from Carrara marble. He preferred that marble. It's harder, and it holds. It doesn't weather dramatically.
Unfortunately, his employer owned a different marble quarry, right?
And his preference was for Carrara marble, but he was also a subject to his patron, who happened to be the Medici, the family Medici that ruled Florence. And he had to do a lot of their bidding, as well as they would take over a lot of his art and so forth and pay him very well for it. And they owned quarries a little bit farther to the south of Carrara, and they wanted him to develop the marble harvesting industry in those quarries. So he spent 5 years in the area of Pietrasanta and north, in a village called Saravizza, and north of that area where they owned this mountain. And it became Michelangelo's mountain, but he did not like the marble from it, and he never carved any art from it. But he spent 5 years trying to do the bidding of the Medici in developing this, and he did no art in that 5 years, which is a
bizarre.
Great loss.
It's kind of bizarre that you would hire somebody who's really good at using marble for art, but why would you hire them to open a marble quarry? That seems like a completely different skill set.
He had the contacts. He knew the people who could be the middlemen in the operation, and that's just what they wanted him to do, and he had to do it. He had designed a facade for San Lorenzo in Venice, excuse me, in Florence, which was the Medici Church. And he had designed it and needed marble for it. And the Medici, of course, said, take the marble from our mountain, not from Carrara. And so that's one of the things he was trying to do, was to find marble to match his design. As it all happened, the Medici Pope, the Medici family lost favor. The Pope died. The Pope Gregory died. And the San Lorenzo never got its facade. Today it's still a very brick-like structure with no beautiful marble on the outside. The whole thing was dropped, and Michelangelo moved on.
Now you avoid in your travels and in your writing, the cliche stops in Italy, but you do write of Pisa, and everybody who's touring Italy goes to Pisa and looks at the Leaning Tower, and then I presume, like me many years ago, turn around, get back on the train, and go to the next thing on the checklist.
That's true. That's true.
So what else is there in Pisa?
There's a lot in Pisa. And I initially, when I thought about this book, I was living in a little village called Pietrasanta, which is full of artists. It's a bit south of Carrara. And there's like 100 sculptors carving, stone carvers in Pietrasanta working any given day. And sitting there, I'm 20 minutes away from Pisa by train. And my decision, I'm not going to write about Pisa because it's like Florence. It's, you know, everybody goes to that particular square. And one Sunday, I put off doing any work, and I just got on the train and went to Pisa, decided I'd better see it. I had ridden through Pisa on the train maybe 15, 20 times over the years and never got off the train to go to that square. It just didn't interest me.
You'd seen the pictures and thought, okay.
Yeah. It wasn't worth it to me to make that short trip. But it was on this day, and I went through the square. It was early in the morning. There weren't a lot of people. But still, the lines were forming for the opening of the big church there. 2.5 hours before the church was opening, it was a huge line. The lines were forming for people getting tickets to get up into the Leaning Tower, and it was a 2.5 hour wait. And I just didn't have the drive to do that. And so I wandered around a historic center of Pisa away from that square, and found wonderful little churches, some of which are not in guidebooks. I carry a guidebook just to give me basic information and to use maps and so forth, and they aren't listed there. And you go in, and there's these remarkable discoveries, and they're empty. There's nobody at all who is more than a local person in these churches and in these places. And then I came across a square with a big church of San Stefano, or Stefano, and there's an order of knights, Maltese knights of San Stefano, and that church was built for them. And inside this church are the battle flags of the Saracens who fought in the Battle of Lepanto and lost to the Christian armies and the Christian navies in that great battle, which stopped the Muslim movement into Europe. And the battle flags that were lost by these invaders of Europe are hanging in that church, and the church is remarkable. It has a Maltese cross everywhere, and those kinds of places are to be found in Pisa.
So that's a great story. How does the average traveler, when you get off the beaten path, you're not with your tourist guide anymore, how do you get those stories when maybe you, like me, you don't speak Italian? So how do you find out the interesting things about the places you're at?
I don't know if you need, I mean, you can, when you travel, sometimes you'll talk to people. Obviously, English speakers, if you don't speak Italian, you'll talk to people and they'll say, oh, you should see this. We discovered this a few years ago, that type of thing. And you can make a goal to go see it for yourself. But what I like to do, and I write about some of the villages in this western part of Tuscany, but you don't have to go to those villages just because they're in the book. What I like to do is get in a car, stay off the autostrada. Even when I'm in sort of a hurry to get north to south or that type of thing, I never, unless it's very rarely, would ever even think about getting on the autostrada, the Italian version of the interstate, and just stay on the blue highways. They have blue highways there as well as we do here. Follow the blue signs to places, and you can get just about anywhere in Italy, and especially western Tuscany, following these little narrow two-lane, sometimes even smaller than two-lane roads, high mountain curves and switchbacks and all of that type of thing, and go from village to village. My goal is to set out every morning without an agenda, to have a map so that I can figure out how to get back to my place of rest each evening, But just start in the morning and start driving and go from place to place, village to village. And when something appeals, you stop and spend time.
And do you find that people in the smaller villages who don't see tourists are thrilled to have someone ask about their town and their landmarks, or are they, because they're not used to tourists, more bashful about it?
They won't walk up to you and ask you questions like young people will, who want to try out their English or something like that in larger places. But they're always friendly. You go into a bar, and an Italian version of a bar is a place where you go get coffee and rolls and perhaps sandwiches and stuff. And, of course, you can get a drink there, too, if you're so inclined. But they're primarily coffee bars where people go for breakfast. They order their espresso and get their croissant, and that's an Italian breakfast. And you go into these places in the small villages because that's where the social scene is. You'll have the pensionati, the retired gentlemen, sitting in their suits or their sport coats and their nice shirts. They dress very well in the interior. And I try to dress that way, too, so I don't stand out so much. No flip-flops, no cutoffs, no Hawaiian shirts when I travel to Italy. I save that for Hawaii. And that's what I used to wear to the office every day, too, when I worked for the newspaper. But I know enough Italian that I can smile and strike up a conversation, and they'll ask me where I'm from in Italian, and I'll do my best to answer and understand what they're asking. But they speak a lot of dialect there, and there are times when I don't understand a single thing. But they're friendly. They understand my frustration with the language. And in one instance, they invited me to play cards with them in this one place, and it's a purely an Italian card game. And they tried to teach it to me, and we spent maybe an hour. And I bought them little glasses of wine, and they bought me coffee because I'm not a wine drinker. And we had a marvelous 2 or 3 hours speaking basic Italian to each other. And they walked me to my car, as older Italian men do, with their arm through my arm. And
wow.
Wished me bon farewell. And you can have experiences like that if you put yourself out.
You know, let's switch gears here a little bit and talk about the business of books. Because it's not, one would think, not especially a great business these days. You see the bookstores closing left and right and being overtaken by e-books. First of all, I presume these are your books or e-books as well.
They are, absolutely. The last two, the Sicily book and this one.
And do they sell better as hardcover, beautiful books you hold in your hand or as digital bites?
I haven't seen the latest. We get what they call royalty reports quarterly from the publisher. But I think it's probably a 50-50 kind of a deal. I probably sell as many e-books as I do hard copies, and of course I like independent bookstores. They're where I prefer to buy books from. But Amazon probably sells most of the books that I do, and probably more than all the bookstores combined. And that's where you get the e-books, and Barnes & Noble and so forth has their own version. So I think the sales are probably 50-50, but don't hold me to those numbers.
And are people still reading? I mean, that's the other worry, is that the notion of sitting and reading an entire book is getting more quaint as attention spans shorten.
I think they do. I think people are still reading. They're certainly still buying the books, and they buy an awful lot of books on the online.
I wouldn't be surprised if more books are sold today in aggregate than 20 years ago, just because it's so easy. And you might be reading them on your Kindle or your iPad, mm-hmm. but you're still reading books.
See, I do it both ways. If I order a book, if a local bookstore, independent bookstore, doesn't have it and I want to get it right away, I'll order a book on Amazon. And don't tell my friends at Weller's that, but I will on occasion. And I may order a digital version. But if I order the digital version, I always get the hard copy for my library. It's just a rule I have because I'm a print person, and I want to hold the book in my hand when I'm home, but when I'm traveling, I've got I've got an iPad with 60, 70 titles in it, and I don't have to carry any books with me in my luggage when I travel.
How about the world of promotion and distribution? You know, it used to be the publishers were the gatekeepers.
Mm-hmm.
And once you got past the gatekeeper, then you had access to promotion and distribution. The world's very different today. The publishers, my understanding is publishers aren't doing that as much. So who is doing that, and how is that evolving?
That's an excellent question, because it's something that's been on my mind since I started this. With my first book, I expected the publisher, I had it in my mind, oh, they'll send me on a reading tour and I'll go to all over the country and do this. Well, they don't do that unless you're a best-selling author. And they don't do it as often as they did 15, 20, 30 years ago and beyond. And the best-selling authors don't need it, but that's who goes out. And occasionally somebody who they think will become a best-selling author. I'm what they call people who do what I do, us travel writers who write travel narratives, unless we're Thoreau or somebody like that. People who do what I do are called mid-list authors, and you don't get a travel budget. You don't get things set up for you. What I did a couple of years ago with the Venice book is I decided I wanted to do my own tour. So at my own expense, I went along California's coast to various cities. I did readings in L.A., San Francisco. I did readings in Oregon, Washington. And I did some readings back east in New York and so forth, but I set it all up myself. The publicists at St. Martin's gave me ideas of who I could call in areas that I didn't know anything about, bookstores and so forth that might be amenable, but I had to do the work. And I'm seriously considering doing the same thing with the Tuscany book, especially for New York State, which is full of Italian Americans.
Let's go back to the subject of your book, Tuscany. You know, anytime I talk to folks, it's very frequent when I talk to somebody that's gone to Italy that their favorite region is Tuscany.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, oh, you have to go to Tuscany. I have a friend listening at home, Bob and Sue Brissetti, and then their granddaughter, Katie's probably listening now, and they love Italy. And they love Tuscany. What is it about Tuscany that's so intoxicating and inviting versus the other areas of Italy?
I think it's because of Florence and the art that first drew people there. You know, 200 years ago, it was part of the Grand Tour. If you were English and with any wealth at all, one of the things that those good folks did was they took the Grand Tour to Italy, and they went to Rome, and they went to Florence, and they went to Venice. And I think a first-time person today who wants to get a sense of Italy, they all have to do that tour, Rome, Florence, Venice. And Florence is what got him into Tuscany. The Etruscan sites for people with a sense of history that are still there and really quite underutilized by visitors. Sort of developed as they would go around in their carriages and later their automobiles, and they would go through these wonderful vineyards and get a sense of a really beautiful, rolling, comfortable place of beauty and so forth beyond the art. The natural landscape is stunning in Tuscany, and I think that's what gets people there. Most American tourists, like I said, spend their time on the eastern side of the Apennines, in Florence, Siena, and so forth. And there's equally beauty and so forth in small villages that are just untrammeled by tourism. You can't even find a postcard in most places.
Well, John, it's been a pleasure to talk to you see after retirement from the Salt Lake Tribune, where everybody saw your byline for decades, that you're having a new success in a second career of writing about Italy. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, John. It was a great book.
The book is Hidden Tuscany, Discovering Art, Culture, and Memories in a Well-Known Region's Unknown Places. And we will be back to wrap up this edition of Mountain Money after this.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
This is Christian Bohr with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Joining the Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Chamber Bureau members enjoy a wide array of benefits, including instant credibility, weekly newsletters with relevant information, educational seminars, webinars, and much more. Information on joining is online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization and a proud supporter of KPCW.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, lrw-law.com. Park City Nursery, we know what grows, parkcitynursery.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Well, I want to thank our great sponsors for Mountain Money each and every Monday at 9:06. The Park City Realty Group, Mountain West Bank, the Iron Mountain Group, Park City Chamber, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, and Jones Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough. And Doug, I just loved the contrast, toxic workplaces, and then we relaxed in Tuscany.
You know, and that worked out really well. That was fascinating talking about not only Tuscany, but the business of publishing, which, as we discussed, has changed quite a bit in the last 10 years.
Indeed. It's getting harder and harder to get published, I believe, through a publisher. John's now done 4 books through St. Martin's Press. But, you know, you can self-publish, too, now on in the e-book world, and that's a topic for another day.
Well, for folks that just love the writing, they want to be an author, that's a path for them to start. They don't have to wait for a big publisher.
Absolutely. In fact, I was on a vacation and bumped into somebody who was started out as an e-published author, just publishing on their own, and they reached such a critical mass that a publisher came to them and said, we want to turn them into hardbacks. So it's a good way to get started. And I know one thing that's going on that has a bee in your bonnet is is an effort to end daylight savings time.
Potentially, yeah. Folks should know that the state of Utah is doing a survey right now wanting to know what the citizens of the state of Utah think of daylight savings time. Should we keep it? Should we get rid of it? And surprising to me, the vote is going against daylight savings time. So if you like coming home from work and being able to mountain bike and maybe grab dinner afterwards outside, that requires it to stay light out till 9 o'clock in the summer.
Ending daylight savings time means it's going to get dark 1 hour earlier after work.
Yeah, we won't bounce ahead. So if you're passionate about bouncing ahead, do a quick Google search. I'll give you the website, but you'll find it just as quickly with a Google search. The website to vote is business.utah.gov/time. Or just look up Utah Daylight Savings Time State Survey and go ahead and let the state know that you want it to stay light out longer.
And what would be the argument against it on the other side?
I don't know.
I guess anybody wouldn't want that.
People like my wife that like to get up early and like it being light out earlier probably.
I guess so. So it's early birds versus late
there you go. The battle is on. If it was up to me, the sun would set at 8 p.m. in Utah year-round. But
you have to live at the equator to get
yes.
that. Well, tomorrow in this space, Chris Cherniak and Noel Larson will host This Green Earth. And their first guest will be Nikki DeFord, who's the head of environmental programs for Vail Resorts. And after that, Chris and Nell talk about the growing incident of people in Park City idling their vehicles on warm summer days so they can run that air conditioning. And it's not only a waste of gas, but it's adding to the ozone levels, and they're going to talk about that subject as well. And I want to thank our great guests, Meredith Ferguson, a professor at Utah State University, talking about the toxic workplace, and John Cahey from Hidden Tuscany, discovering art, culture, and memories in a well-known region's unknown places. And Doug, one last mention. Next week on our program, we're going to talk about John's former employee, the Salt Lake Tribune. and the lawsuit to prohibit some would say the dismantling of the Salt Lake
Tribune. It's an important topic.
It absolutely is, and we will go through that tomorrow. And this is Mountain Money on KPCW Park City.